Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us again on another Sunday. Our show today, Government and Climate Reporter with Charlottesville Tomorrow, Charlotte Woods. Good morning, Charlotte.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us today. You've got a lot of articles out there, a lot of things that are important to the area as we talk about recent and local news. I'm so happy to have you with us.
Thank you for reaching out.
First time with the show, although we've had Charlottesville Tomorrow here for a number of years. You can find Charlottesville Tomorrow and Charlotte's articles at cvilletomorrow.org. And a lot of the things that we'll be discussing today, cvilletomorrow.org. But let's get started with Charlotte Woods. Charlotte, you've been doing a lot of the articles about the government and how the events take place, and we'll get into the voting. Can you tell me, with the virus, how are these meetings taking place, and how are you attending the meetings?
Yeah, basically, since March, so many people have been working from home, if able, and their company or organization permits. So a lot of local and state government meetings are broadcast. And then for city council and board of supervisors, these are happening in Zoom meetings. So I like to joke that for the last, well, more than 6 months. But yeah, basically since March, most days I get to work from my couch or my home office in my sweatpants. And yeah. And then with things happening over Zoom, the public comment period is where, you can, if you're familiar with Zoom, you can like metaphorically raise your hand. And then when it's time for you to speak, you're given your chance to participate in the meeting. That's what's been happening.
In your, if you compare pre-March and post-March, do you feel that this has had any effect on the meeting results, the outcomes, how things are being done? Not in their, not in the fact that it's being done by Zoom, but just the participation numbers, et cetera. Has it had any sort of effect?
Usually you can sign up in advance to speak at city council or board of supervisors or planning commission or whatever meeting that you are attending virtually, just like you would when you're attending in person. They try to stick to that. If the sign up slots aren't completely full, anyone who wishes to speak during the time can. I guess in terms of participation, it's hard to have quantitative data on that just because I don't believe that everything was recorded on how many people are attending or watching before it was all virtual. I will say it probably gives a little bit of easier access for people if they're able to multitask and, pop in and pop out of a city council or board supervisor meeting while they're doing other things. On the other hand, it can be limiting for people who live in areas of the county in particular that may not have very good Wi-Fi and broadband access. So it's pretty tit for tat in terms of like how much technology helps us, but how much sometimes being able to just show up might be helpful as well.
All right. Again, our guest today is Charlotte Woods. She's a reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow, and she's been doing a lot on the voting issues. And so let's jump into that, because with the upcoming presidential election, and it's a little bit more than that, there's several other pieces on the upcoming ballot. You can vote for senator, you can vote for some local pieces on the ballot as well. So, Charlotte, one of the articles that you had written was just the simple different ways that you can vote, how to vote. Can you go through that with us? Because I think in the past, it would have been quite simple, or people wouldn't have been as interested in the different ways. Hey, I'm just going to go vote. Hey, right? That's all people would have cared about. It's more like where to vote before, not how to vote now.
Exactly. Yeah, so because there's a global pandemic happening right now, it wouldn't be safe if everyone flocked to the polls on November 3rd. So that's why early in-person voting, there's so much time between now and October 31st to walk into your local registrar's office, limited capacity, socially distanced, and cast your vote that way if that's what you want. You can also request your mail-in absentee ballot, which there have been recent state laws amended for this year where in the past you would need to provide a reason why you couldn't vote in person, and you would need to provide a witness signature of someone else who watched you vote for it to count. Both of those things have been waived this year because of the pandemic, and encouraging people, especially people with who are more high risk to, you know, being exposed to COVID, to vote from home, to request absentee ballots. Of course, there's also still always the option to go on November 3rd to your polling precinct, which you can look up by going on Virginia Department of Elections and going on to look at your local registrar's office. And then the other option, there are four this year, is to request your ballot by mail. And then instead of mailing it back in, if you want to tangibly, like, drop it off and that gives you peace of mind, you can take it to your local registrar, or you can drop it off at these ballot drop boxes that are outside of your local registrar's office that were approved by General Assembly during special session this summer. There's lots of options. I find interesting because it's made voting more accessible this year. In the past, if you can't get off work on time or it's too much of a hassle to go vote on election day, you have the one day to do it. I feel like this year if you want to vote, there's no excuse not to. You have so many options in it. I think it might make it easier too. So, but then there's the added factor that, you know, it's a pandemic. So, you know, weigh your options carefully if you want to go in person or if you want to do absentee.
Well, Charlotte, when we talk about the different ways to vote, you talk about mail-in or absentee voting, and that that has been waived or made easier. Is that a permanent amendment been waived permanently?
I don't know if that's just for this year or if that's permanent, but that actually is an article that I'm working on for next week. I wanted to look into, based on how things work out this year, is our state planning on making it this way going forward, or is this just a for however long COVID lasts thing?
We know that to get one, you just go to the Virginia Department of Elections and request. In the past, there used to be requirements, special requirements. Are those requirements are no longer needed?
Nope. They've waived it this year.
So you can just...
As long as you're a registered voter and you request one, you can get one.
But if you want to mail it in, when do I need to do so? What are my... when is my ballot due?
Yes. So your ballot needs to be mailed. The last day to request one is October 23rd, but it needs to mail it in, request it as soon as you want to, mail it in as soon as you want to, drop it off. But it has to be received or at least postmarked by November 3rd, because then ballots will be counted until the Friday after the election, as is standard, which would be November 6th. Vote as soon as you possibly can, and it has to be received or postmarked by November 3rd.
And in the past, I was under the belief that I had to have somebody witness my signature.
Not needed this year. When I voted in the primaries, I still had living with my partner, so I had them be my witness and sign just in case. And when I've spoken with registrars, they've said, if you have a witness, go ahead, just why not? But it is not needed. Your vote will not be disqualified if you don't have one, at least this year.
Okay. All right. So those are the main parts of doing a mail-in or an absentee voting in Charlottesville or Albemarle County. But then there's the traditional November 3rd, go to your local precinct. Are there the same voting spots as usual? Because a lot of cities or states in around, you know, nationally have been in the news. You hear about them reducing the number of voting precincts because of COVID-19.
That is a very good question, and I am actually planning on following up that as well as when we get closer to November 3rd, just because not all polling places may stay the same this year. It depends on what our local boards of elections have planned. So just as the voter guide is ongoing this year, every time there's questions that pop up or I'm preemptively thinking about what questions might people be asking in the next week or two, I will always try to have an article available.
So keep that in mind and go back to seavilletomorrow.org as it gets closer to November 3rd if you plan on voting live on election, traditional election day. Is that what you're saying?
Yep, exactly.
Okay. Our guest today, Charlotte Woods, she writes for Charlottesville Tomorrow, and you can find her articles at seavilletomorrow.org. Are there, as far as the November 3rd election day, are there any other tips or changes in protocol that have already been stated that you're aware of? I mean, with the... Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Just like early in-person voting started on September 18th, and it will last till October 31st, and then when regular election day voting happens on November 3rd, all of the in-person voting, they're maintaining social distancing. There will be personal protective equipment worn. Surfaces will be continuously sanitized. So just making it as safe as possible.
Okay. So what if I want to, I'm unsure about mailing in my ballot, but I don't want to vote on November 3rd. So I've requested my ballot, but I somehow don't want to mail it back, or I'm unsure, you know, just because I'm unsure about the length of time it may take. How does this work?
Yeah, you can request by mail, and then if you want to actually know that it, physically see that it got to your registrar, you can take it there during in-person early voting, which is still ongoing right now. You can also drop it off at these ballot drop boxes. So there's one that is outside of Albemarle County's office building that's on 5th Street, and then there's the one for Charlottesville is outside of Charlottesville's registrar office.
When can Virginia start opening and counting these paper ballots? Because one of the things that has been mentioned, I guess it came up again in the debate that took place the other night, was that some states can't even open the ballots until election day. Is Virginia one of these states?
Thank you for supplying me with an idea for another follow-up article. I know that I did recently check in an article that is coming out. I have been checking in with registrars on what to do, what their protocol is if they receive ballots that have errors. So maybe you sent your ballot in, but you didn't put it into the extra internal envelope, then it normally wouldn't count. So then, given new state law that passed this year during the special legislative session, in the past, if a ballot was incorrect, it would just be tossed. But now registrars can follow up with voters, reach out to them, have them come in and correct things, or resend a new ballot and start fresh.
Really? So are those concerns on the do those concerns take place on the voter's side, or do those concerns discovered at the registrar's office?
That is discovered at the registrar's office. In terms of concerns discovered on the voter's side, Charlottesville, I know this week, had a handful of ballots that they sent out that actually had the envelopes but didn't have the ballots. And they're working to correct that. And just like everyone is urging voters, if you can and want to, vote as early as possible, so that way if there are any hiccups, it can be corrected. So if you happen to receive a ballot that is not complete, definitely reach back out to your registrar as soon as possible to talk about getting a new one sent to you or coming in.
Okay. Our guest today is Charlotte Wood. She's a journalist for Charlottesville Tomorrow. And we've been talking about how to vote this year in the presidential election, and whether you want to go out on the traditional election day, November 3rd, or whether you choose to use a paper ballot, and how to get one and get it back in and take care of things that way. Charlotte, we've got a break coming up shortly, so I'm going to go and do things a little backwards. I want to skip. We've got two amendments coming up, constitutional amendments. I'm going to do amendment number, the second one that you write about, the veteran vehicle tax relief.
Yes.
Let's discuss that one first, because it seems to be a little less argumentative.
It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
So in the state of Virginia constitutional amendment proposals, they have to pass 2 years in a row before they can end up on the ballot as a referendum. And that is the case with this one. It passed in 2019. Speaker of the House, Eileen Phillip Corn, put it forth. And then this year it was Senator Bryce Reeves, who is part of our district. He is, yeah, part of Albemarle County, I believe, is in his district. So what the amendment says is that it would add one vehicle to be tax exempt for veterans that are 100% disabled. And Reeves said he was inspired to carry the legislation because he was thinking about veterans who maybe are missing limbs that they lost while serving our country. And he said that this is a way to thank them, especially considering if you're 100% disabled, you may have special needs for your car, which, you know, maybe like an extension for your brake pedals to reach it or something like that, which it costs more money. So it's a way to just do something nice for veterans. It was a pretty straightforward amendment. And now it's in the hands of Virginian voters. We can decide, do we want to allow our veterans to have a tax exemption on one of their vehicles, or do we not?
If it passes, would it start on January 1st of 2021?
It would. So then veterans who want to apply to have that, they would be eligible then.
Would you get reimbursed for taxes they might have paid in 2019?
No, the language of the amendment definitely outlined that. So that way, from this point forward, if it passes starting January 2021, going forward, then if 100% labeled disabled soldiers would qualify and apply for that, then it would start then.
Okay. Let's take our break, and we'll come right back. And I got one more question on that, then we'll move forward. Charlotte Woods here. She's a journalist. Charlottesville Tomorrow. Hang tight, everybody. All right. Thanks for being with us again. And Charlotte Woods here with us. Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can read her articles and all the articles. SeavilleTomorrow.org. Charlotte, we were talking about the amendment about veteran vehicle tax relief for 100% disabled veterans. Are there any folks who are against this possible constitutional amendment?
Not that I've spoken to too much. I think it's the fact that it passed General Assembly to end up on our ballots for us to vote for it kind of speaks to the bipartisan support that it's garnered in our General Assembly. And the fact that it's been carried by Republican and Democratic legislators. So really, it's just now up to us to decide if we want to amend part of our state constitution to include this as a specialized niche tax amendment, personal property.
All right. Well, let's move on to the other constitutional amendment that will appear on your ballot. Tell us a little bit about this one.
It has been a long time in the making. Yes. So just for quick backstory and just context, voting district maps for our state legislative body, as well as for Congress, for House of Representatives, those are drawn every 10 years based on census data. Probably we are all familiar with getting census forms in the mail every decade. So that helps figure out what the demographic makeup is of the state, and then maps are drawn. And in the state of Virginia, presently, the General Assembly draws maps, which some people have argued for a while that that doesn't seem like it's something that should be happening, legislators drawing their own districts. And then with the ebb and flow of the majority and minority party, it's always a heated issue. Redistricting, it's never easy for legislators to build consensus on, because there's always the fear that you might lose your seat or, yeah. So basically, for a very long time, there has been advocacy and growing bipartisan support to tackle redistricting reform. And this year, the first amendment that's on the ballot at the top, amendment number one, would create, if it's passed, it would create a bipartisan redistricting commission that would be composed of both legislators and citizen appointees. And it's designed to take some of the potential partisan sway out of district drawing and to eliminate gerrymandering, which is the act of drawing maps that could favor or disfavor a political party or a demographic of people. So it's aimed to really just kind of make things more fair. And it has the support of Democrats and Republicans. Although in the final hour, there are some in the Democratic Party that are starting to urge people to vote no on it. They are worried about the fact that the language of the amendment, while it would create this commission, they are worried that it still won't end certain types of gerrymandering, and they are cautious about the fact that legislators will be on the commission, because the ultimate goal, I have heard from Republicans and Democrats, is eventually they don't want legislators on the commission. They hope that the commission could be fully composed of citizens.
Well, so in reading your article, the amendment says that if passed, it would create a commission composed of 8 legislators, 4 from each party, and 8 citizens who are selected from retired judges.
Correct.
So how are the 8 legislators determined?
The top officials in each chamber would be choosing. So, you know, like Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, and then the other person below that. So, it would be those people choosing the legislators that would serve on the commission. And then they would have a little bit of input on who the citizen appointees are, because each of them gets to propose a list of at least 16 citizens that they could recommend. But they are not making the final say.
And then who selects these 8 citizen judges?
The list of retired judges comes from recommendations from General Assembly. So that is part of why there is some critique and concern from some lawmakers who are changing their mind about supporting this amendment. It's because they worry that there's still a little too much input from General Assembly from the viewpoint of the commission. And meanwhile, others are saying this is the best compromise we've reached forever, and we should just at least try this as a start.
Is there any requirement, did I miss something, that these legislators and the citizens be from different parts of the state?
No.
So theoretically, the 8 legislators and citizens could all be from the Northern Virginia area.
Perhaps. That's okay. That's an unknown, and that's part of why people are a little bit afraid right now to go ahead and try this. And
If passed, would it be used in the based on the outcome from the 2020 census?
Yes. So if it passes, the commission would start from January until March, using 2020 census data to start composing their maps. The maps would need like a supermajority vote. So that means that like 6 out of the 8 legislators and 6 out of the 8 citizens would need to agree in order for the maps to end up being presented to General Assembly, which they can vote it up or vote it down, but they can't amend it. So that's how that would function.
And what happens if the amendment fails?
If it fails, then the maps, I believe there's another chance to try again, but then the maps would ultimately end up going to the Supreme Court of Virginia to be drawn, which is how the process works now. If General Assembly theoretically couldn't draw its own maps and reach consensus, then it goes to SCOTUS. Supreme Court of Virginia is always the fail-safe.
Our guest today is Charlotte Woods. She's a journalist at Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find her articles and so many others at cvilletomorrow.org. We're currently talking about one of the constitutional amendments that's on the ballot at the November election, or possibly the October election, depending on when you plan to vote. You can pick up a ballot at just about any time. You can mail in. You can go to Virginia Department of Elections and request the ballot. Mail it in, drop it off, go downtown Charlottesville, go out to Albemarle County, 5th Street, and vote then. Although, Charlotte, you can't go just any time to vote, correct?
Right. It has to be when your registrar's offices are open. So, for Albemarle County at their 5th Street Extended Office Building, early in-person voting is from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And then on Tuesdays, it's from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Additionally, it will be open on Saturdays from 9 to 5, but that's only the last 2 Saturdays of October. And then for City Hall, City Hall's annex for Charlottesville, it's on a walk-in basis during their normal office hours, which they, I believe they close at 4:30. And then from 8:30 to 5, also on the last 2 Saturdays in October. It's right around the corner. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So, Charlotte, we were talking about this constitutional amendment on to prevent gerrymandering and to help with the 2020 census and going forward. Can you tell me and tell listeners, what is prison gerrymandering?
That is, it's actually practiced in many states. I think with the new law that Virginia passed, HB, House Bill 1255 and Senate Bill 717, that would outlaw various forms of gerrymandering, including that, makes Virginia, I think, maybe 9 out of 50 states to rule it out. Prison gerrymandering is when the populations of incarcerated individuals are counted as numbers inside a voting district, even though those individuals don't have the right to vote. And when they get out of prison and serve their term and maybe want their rights restored, they may not even be in the jurisdiction where they're incarcerated. So people have advocated against prison gerrymandering because it could skew how you draw a map when it looks like there's a higher population density in an area when a significant portion of those voters counted aren't actually able to vote.
Fascinating. Your article mentioned an organization called Fair Districts. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So, One Virginia 2021 is the, the redistricting reform advocacy group that has been working for this for over a decade, and they launched Fair Maps over the summer as a political action committee to do outreach. And to counter that, the legislators and activists who have decided they don't want to support the proposed amendment started Fair Maps as their political action committee for outreach on urging you how to vote no. So you have these two groups saying vote yes and vote no. And they all have valid reasons for why they say vote yes and vote no. So I hope that in reading my article and maybe listening to this today helps you figure out what option you want.
Is there are there any polls on this constitutional amendment on where folks stand now?
Yeah, Christopher Newport University, who I spoke with, their political analyst for the article as well, they recently put out a poll that shows that there are 48% of Virginian voters that were polled that are in favor, and 28% are opposing it, and then there are 24% of polled people who are undecided. Polls, I think, are helpful at being a bit of a bellwether, but they're not 100% accurate because you're always subject to the sample size, because there's plenty of people who probably aren't polled. So it's definitely a helpful guiding force to see that at least out of this, you can see like how close it could be depending on how much the undecided voters sway.
Certainly, Constitutional Amendment Number 2. This is its second year, obviously, if it would start by using the 2020 census if it passed, correct?
Could you restate that? I'm not sure I understand.
So you said with the veterans tax relief, you said that to become an actual functioning amendment, it has to pass for 2 years.
Correct. And so Constitutional Amendment Number 1.
So this must also be in its second year, correct?
Correct. It passed, it passed in 2019, and then it passed again in 2020. There was also an election in between, too. And that is another factor, is now Democrats have the majority. So it makes sense that some of the Democrats are changing their mind right now because, you got the majority. You promised to draw the maps fairly. And regardless, the House Bill 1255 and Senate Bill 717 are law now. So whether the commission is drawing the maps, if it passes, or if General Assembly is drawing the maps next year, that is in place. But part of why people are asking us voters, to not pass the amendment is that they want to wait until they can try again. The earliest would be 2022, to also include some of the anti-gerrymandering language from House Bill 1255 and Senate Bill 717 into the constitutional amendment. So, like I said, yes, it's complicated. You can advocate for it or against it very easily.
I'm curious. I'll ask you this. How difficult is it for you as a journalist for something like this? Do you find your thought process and your personal decision-making enhanced or skewed at different times on something like this?
Ooh, that is an intense question. as a reporter, I get to learn so much, and my job is to be a sponge, basically, and get all the information I can and then translate and contextualize it out to voters and out to readers for all kinds of stories. For me, it's just like on something like this, yeah, when you dive in deep like I did and you learn all about it, there's a reason I haven't voted yet, but I'm planning to within the next week. So just, you know, I'm sorry if I probably didn't finish answering your question.
Well, I can see where you can, I would think that it's, you almost have to divide yourself into the work Charlotte and the personal Charlotte, and the work Charlotte does her work and reads about it and interviews people and then processes it and writes an article. And the personal Charlotte has to, I ask the question as though it would, reading this would lean me towards one way to vote and then maybe pull me back and lean me towards another way and pull me back and, you know, where I would be on the day that I voted. That's sort of where I went with that question.
Yeah, I guess this is probably one of the more complicated things that I've written about in a very long time. It's one of the more complicated things that we as voters have to contemplate when we're going into the polls, whether it's through mail or in person. You can read all about your candidates. And you'll have your own political party affiliations, but something like this that got bipartisan support and is still divided, this is a tricky question, and it's so important, and I just really hope that people can tally up the pros and cons and vote with your hope and your feelings on this, because it will determine our maps in some way for the next 10 years.
Okay, let's take a break. Charlotte Wood is our guest today here, Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be right back. And here we are, Sunday morning. Thank you for being with us today. We also want to thank Charlotte Woods for being with us. She's a journalist. Charlottesville Tomorrow, CVilleTomorrow.org. Charlotte had the pleasure of interviewing Senator Mark Warner not too long ago. Charlotte, how did that go? I'm curious, in the old days, what does that mean, pre-March of this year?
Yeah.
You might have sat down across from him, chair facing chair, and done that. Is that how it goes nowadays, or is it Zoom facing Zoom?
Yeah, it's definitely at the beginning of the year, I sat down with Denver Riggleman and Cameron Webb. I kicked off the voter guide with those two and just continued over the past several months interviewing all of the candidates for the House Congressional 5th Congressional District and for Senate ahead of the primaries and after the primaries. And originally, I was trying to meet with every candidate in their favorite spot in the state or their favorite spot in the 5th Congressional District. And yeah, just spending an hour with each person to talk as much policy or personal matters as we wanted to, because you know, at the end of the day, these legislators, they're not just voting robots, they're humans. So I really, sometimes you always see them, their names attached to policy and or sound clips on TV. I really wanted everyone to just get to know the candidates and the elected officials a bit more. But yeah, like COVID hit, so definitely, like when I interviewed Bob Good, it was over the phone for an hour. When I interviewed Mark Warner, I did get to see him in person, though. He was in Charlottesville a few weeks ago for a couple of campaign events, and I wasn't, you know, as the incumbent sitting senator during a pandemic and a campaign season, he's a bit busier than some of the other candidates. So I managed to get 20 minutes of one-on-one time. I got to sit across from him at a picnic table outside of Champion Brewing, and we chatted for 20 minutes. And having the limited time, I had to really make sure that I had all my questions ready. And then the fact that he was also in town for a couple more different campaign events, I attended those to listen to him and speak with him a little bit more at those events as well. And it totaled up to be about an hour. So it was great to get time with him. Also, I have lived in Virginia since 2016. I always get press releases from him. I see him around, but I had never had one-on-one time with him yet. So being the politics nerd that I am, it was great. I had already talked to Tim Kaine before, but now I got to talk to Mark Warner. So that was fun for me.
So a lot of what you've written, your interview, your one-on-one time, and attending his visit to Charlottesville will be in the voting guide. Correct?
Correct.
But is there a memorable moment that you can share with us?
I thought it was interesting to learn some of the backstory of his influence on helping get some of the earlier COVID legislation passed through Congress, like helping make sure that PPP, which is Paycheck Protection Program, got passed. And he has experience, you know, having been a venture capitalist before being a legislator, and just like being able to have that input and that insight on how to help companies when they're financially struggling from the impact of a global pandemic disrupting everything. And it was really interesting. There was a quote from him that he goes, quote, "I never thought that I would have had a relationship with Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary." But yeah, he, I guess, was speaking with Steven Mnuchin to help make some of those things happen. And considering Warner is not the biggest fan of President Trump, he has made strides in his tenure as senator so far, building bipartisanship, finding compromise, working across the aisle. And he cites that as one of his strong points. And certainly, I get a lot of press releases from his office, and there's almost always at least one or more Republicans co-sponsored on a lot of what he signs.
All right. So everybody can go to the voting guide at Charlottesville tomorrow. And aside from reading about the Mark Warner interview, you can read about all the candidates in your area and help make the decision, as well as on the amendments. So let's go along to some of the other articles that you've written. One of the more recent ones, Albemarle County's Climate Action Plan, one of your latest articles. I saw that the last time Albemarle County revised anything in their action plan was March of 2020. And the action plan covers everything from renewable energy sourcing to structural inequities. What's going on with Albemarle County's climate action plan?
Yeah, so phase one is set to be adopted at the October 7th Board of Supervisor meeting. And it got tweaked a little bit more over the summer. They originally planned on presenting in March and approving then. But then everything got pushed pause a little bit because of the pandemic for a while. And so the county officials decided to use that time over the earlier parts of this summer, April and May, to field even more input, to show the draft, just to pop it up online and offer a questionnaire period where feedback was provided. Then they conferred with other experts like transportation department within Albemarle County, for example, to add a couple more actionable items and tweak the plan a little bit more. And now the final draft version this week, it will be approved. And then that said, there's also climate advocacy group Seaville 100 that are petitioning the county to include a bit more meaty action items on installing solar on government rooftops. So when I was speaking with county officials that have been working on the climate action plan, they see that more as a phase two thing, but this group is urging it to be incorporated into phase two or phase one. So that could be a topic of discussion coming up as well. And given that the Virginia Clean Economy Act passed this year, it expands the solar energy portfolio for the state of Virginia. So there's opportunity.
So, Charlotte, would Albemarle County get any funding help from the state or federal if they put solar panels on their buildings?
What they could do and what they have done in the past is used power purchase agreements, which helps eliminate some of the upfront costs of installing solar panels, and then it gets paid back over time. And people who, you know, support using those, as it's like a way to immediately take action, reducing some of like the upfront like costs, which sometimes could be prohibitive. And then also the advocates are saying that this could be a job creation thing during a time when the pandemic has affected so many different industries. One of our freelance reporters over the summer actually wrote about how the Virginia Clean Economy Act could help with job creation around the state, and then not to mention just, you know, saving in utility bills if you're generating some or if not all of your own electricity through solar.
All right. So let's move to another topic, another article you wrote. The Mental Health Crisis Task Force. I've got this one. You wrote this on September 24th. And there's a quote in here in your article. Calls for criminal justice reform throughout the nation. I guess it was one of the reasons for putting the Mental Health Crisis Task Force together. And this
was
in the city of Charlottesville, right?
Correct. Yes.
Go ahead. Tell me more.
That was almost part of like a trilogy of articles I was working on over the summer. After George Floyd's death, obviously we saw a lot of demonstrations and protests spark up around the country, certainly around Virginia and here in Charlottesville. And calls for criminal justice reform intersect with a lot of other things. And part of that has been mental health related crisis response. With different cities around the U.S. have developed different programs where they have like a mobile crisis unit that can respond either alongside or in place of law enforcement for people who are having a mental health crisis and may not necessarily need to be, you know, sent to jail overnight. They need to be sent to a counselor or spend some night under observation at a hospital, or just, you know, have a trained mental health clinician who can just kind of like talk them down and soothe them and prevent anything bad from happening. So there's been calls for trying out something like, I know Portland, Oregon has a program that does that. And throughout the summer, there have been some suggestions of that. And one of the local mental health advocates in Charlottesville named Myra Anderson, she suggested a task force composed of mental health professionals, organizations that are already providing some of the care, law enforcement, local government, as well as people who have experience receiving mental health related, you know, care and first aid, to kind of speak from experience of what might be helpful at de-escalating situations and getting people the help that they need. And so she's been reaching out to city councilors and speaking about it for a while. And I know that there has been, when I was speaking with counselors throughout the summer, they were saying there's support of this idea of exploring something, whatever would work best for this community. And it was just a matter of the logistics. And now they are going to be assembling a team in the next few weeks. I'll keep an eye on that if there's any follow-ups. But yeah, in the near future, Charlottesville will have a task force that can examine what type of crisis response model related to mental health works best for this community, and make recommendations for policy for council to decide to use in the future.
Was there a specific incident in Charlottesville that prompted the city wanting a task force, or were these more national issues that brought this about?
It was definitely a combination of things. A particular incident that happened over the summer was in early July. There was a man on the downtown mall who he has a lot of his criminal record shows that he's been arrested for intoxication multiple times in Virginia Beach and in Charlottesville. And substance abuse is a mental health issue. And so when that happened and he was arrested, there was body cam footage released, and it kind of renewed this these conversations about different types of crisis response and diverting people from the criminal justice system who might need other types of help. And it also goes in with recent national and even Virginia things. In 2018 in Richmond, there was Marcus David Peters was having a mental breakdown and ended up being killed. And that's why I know Myra Anderson, she was saying that, like, you know, this task force that Charlottesville creates can monitor what happens with state legislation called the Marcus Alert, which would be another way to tackle, like, okay, well, how do we adjust our crisis response to know and talk to our 911 dispatchers to triage a situation and realize, well, maybe law enforcement doesn't need to respond to this, or maybe they need clinicians as backup, or maybe clinicians need to respond. So I think when you pair some things that have happened locally, things that have happened nearby, and then just the general movements that have been happening nationwide this summer, it just kind of reached this moment where everything coalesced and legislators, well, local city councilors are realizing, okay, well, let's try this out. Let's see what could work for our community and hear back from members of the community.
Would the funding for this task force come from the police department budget?
When I spoke with Councillor Snook and McGill, Councillor Lord Snook and Councillor Tina McGill, who would be probably spearheading this from the council side of things, they say there's not enough details just yet. The idea has been percolating. They know that they want to establish it, but the nitty-gritty details haven't been finalized yet, but that there will be more information in coming weeks. So I definitely plan on keeping in contact with Myra Anderson, Councillor Snook, Councillor McGill, and any other councillors just to learn what the nitty-gritty details would be. And also checking in with law enforcement. I know that Charlottesville Police Department does have crisis intervention team, which is a subset of police officers who have received crisis intervention training to some degree. So it's kind of like building off of all of the collective training protocols that are already in place. And in terms of like what funding could look like, that's a question for later.
All right. So our guest today is Charlotte Woods. As we talk about recent and local news, she writes for Charlottesville Tomorrow. So Charlotte, just I say 3 minutes left. So for this last article about Charlottesville City Council approving an ordinance on banning guns, restricted firearms in city-owned buildings, city parks, community centers, and on public streets or rights of way used by or adjacent to permitted events. Again, less than 3 minutes. Can you tell us a little more?
In speaking with multiple city councilors, they told me that this is something that they have wanted to do for a very long time. It wasn't possible until this summer when state law took effect that gave local governments more authority to do something like this. Being a Dillon Rule state, there's a lot that local government has been restricted on that has to default to General Assembly for state government to approve. But certain laws passed over the summer that do grant local governments a bit more authority and wiggle room on certain things. So once that took effect on July 1st, then City Council started drafting their ordinance. Previously, it was delayed a little bit by Councilor Snook because he wanted to double check with the Commonwealth Attorney on the language and make sure that he said it was, quote, bulletproof, that it couldn't be challenged. And now it will be, it's been passed. And I do also know part of it, at least Snook said, was inspired from the events of August 11th and 12th in 2017. So council just wanted to be able to have certain areas where, unless you're law enforcement, you should not be taking your guns.
Charlottesville was not the first city to do this. I saw where Newport News and Richmond, who did it about the same time, Newport News did it earlier. I read that in your article. Has anybody had to go to court yet?
So far, I'm not sure, but I definitely wouldn't be surprised if some people or some organizations or groups do challenge it. I mean, that's what... it's what people do. It's like you can say, I want this law or I don't want this law. And then that's why we have different branches of government. We have legislative, judicial, and executive.
Again, our guest today, as we talked about recent and local news, our journalist Charlotte Woods with Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can find her articles at sevilletomorrow.org. Charlotte, thank you so much for being with us today. A lot of fascinating and important material out there.
Thank you for having me. And also just in discussing the different stories, I want to follow up on so many things. I have more questions. I want to give more answers.
Well, the voting guide is out there, sevilletomorrow.org. And more material comes up, one or two articles every week, correct?
For the voting night specifically, yes. For our newsroom, a bit more.
Right. One or two articles by you and many more on Charlottesville Tomorrow altogether.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
Next week's topic with the International Rescue Committee and Harriet Kaur. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next Sunday.
Thank you.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at sevillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.